This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, retired U.S. Senator Bob Graham joins hosts to talk about Saudi Arabia's possible role in the 9/11 attacks. The senator contends that the Saudi Arabian monarchy was part of a support network which helped plan, pay for, and execute the attacks on September 11, 2001. We'll also hear an encore interview with author James W. Douglas. His book is titled JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Was Kennedy killed because he was turning toward peace and taking steps to end the Cold War and get out of Vietnam?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Catherine Franke. I'm a law professor at Columbia Law School, and I chair the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Retired U.S. Senator Bob Graham from Florida is the former head of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee. He's also the leading person trying to get President Obama to release to the public the suppressed 28 pages of the 9/11 report, which until now had been hidden. Senator Graham contends that the 19 hijackers, 15 of whom were Saudi Arabians, could not have pulled off the operation alone, and that in fact they were part of a support network involving the Saudi Arabian monarchy and government, which helped plan, pay for, and execute the complicated 9/11 plot. Senator Graham said otherwise it would have been impossible for them to accomplish this. Senator Graham has written the book called Intelligence Matters, the CIA, FBI, Saudi Arabia, and the Failure of America's War on Terror. It provides a candid insight to the workings of the U.S. in Saudi relations and their implications on U.S. foreign policy making as it pertains to the Middle East. Senator Graham, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
We'd like to start by just asking a bit about your background, where you grew up, what the influence of your father was, and what positions you hold in the U.S. Senate.
I grew up on a dairy farm about 25 miles northwest of Miami. I was very influenced by my surroundings, which were the Everglades, a passion of mine. I was very much influenced by my parents. My father was a very wise man. He was also a very high integrity person and had run and been elected to the Florida State Senate in order to be a factor in cleaning out some of the corruption which had afflicted South Florida during the post-World War or pre-World War II period. That was a significant influence on my subsequent decision to pursue a career in elective office, and I frequently used the examples and lessons that I had learned from my parents in various political decisions that I had to make.
Senator, you served on the 9/11 Commission when you were still in the Senate, and you've said in the past that you became disillusioned. And I wanted to ask you, why was that?
Well, I did not serve on the 9/11 Commission, which was a citizens' commission. I co-chaired, as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the joint inquiry of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees into 9/11, with particular focus on the role of the U.S. intelligence agencies. After we finished our inquiry, which was in December of 2002, the Citizens Commission accepted our voluminous materials that we had developed and an over 800-page report, and they commenced their investigation, which went beyond the Intelligence Committee to a number of other agencies, such as the role of the Federal Aviation
Senator, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabians. Do you believe they could plan, pay for, and execute the complex plot of 9/11 involving hijacking of airplanes without external support?
Absolutely not. These 19 people, most of them did not speak English. Most of them had never been to the United States before. Most of them were not particularly well educated. That they could carry out a plot of this sophistication over a time period, which for some of them was 18 months, and avoid detection is implausible. That's the word that the chairs of the 9/11 Commission have used to describe this matter. It is implausible to me that the United States government, 15 years later, still clings to the position that these 19 people did in fact operate alone without any external support, and therefore their inquiries have, in my opinion, been very unnecessarily truncated because they haven't gone into the question of who were the groups that supported the 9/11 hijackers, because they don't believe they exist. The U.S. government does not believe that an external support network exists.
And specifically, who do you believe that external support network consists of?
Primarily Saudis. As you stated, 15 of the 19 hijackers were themselves Saudi nationals with government involvement, were the primary funders of al-Qaeda and continue to be a primary funder, as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said during her tenure, that the primary source of funding of terrorism was Saudi Arabia. And I also, Saudi Arabia has been the principal promoter of this extreme form of Islam called Wahhabism, where young people are taught intolerance, jihad, and encouraged to act out against non-believers, and therefore have provided a steady stream of fresh recruits to terrorist organizations, from al-Qaeda to now ISIS.
Senator, why do you think that the United States government ignored the warnings that something terrible was going to happen prior to 9/11? And then my next question is going to be, why haven't they been more forthright in discussing who might have done it afterwards? But let's talk about before 9/11. Isn't it true that the president gets a daily briefing, and mightn't he have been warned about this?
Yes, and he was. The 9/11 Commission developed the concept, it was a lack of imagination, that we knew a significant amount about al-Qaeda and about what its intentions were. They had tried to hijack airplanes in the Philippines several years before 9/11. They had been the primary operatives in the attacks on two U.S. embassies in Africa, so they were not an unknown adversary. But with all of that, we didn't have the imagination that they might be plotting to attack not thousands of miles away on another continent, but attack in the United States and use as the means of that attack the same technology, commercial airliners, that they had tried to use in the Philippines.
After the attack, there's 28 pages of the report that haven't been released. And I know that you're under constraints and can't talk about what's in those pages, but I know you've written a book called Keys to the Kingdom, which is a novel about that. And I wondered whether you might talk about the novel so we could try to understand what's been suppressed.
First, about the 28 pages. The final report that was submitted in December of 2002 was over 800 pages. One chapter of 28 pages was totally redacted, and that chapter has been publicly acknowledged as primarily dealing with who financed 9/11 and pointed a very strong finger at Saudi Arabia, not surprisingly. I wrote a book called Intelligence Matters which is a nonfiction book about the before 9/11, during, and then the investigation afterwards. There was a significant amount of that book which was censured. I was frustrated by that, and while I was a senior fellow at the Kennedy School, one of the faculty members suggested that I could tell the stories that were excluded from the nonfiction Intelligence Matters by writing it as a novel. So that was the origin of Keys to the Kingdom. I say Intelligence Matters asks the questions, and Keys to the Kingdom gives the answers.
Senator, tell us a bit about the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandor. Why did he get President Bush to allow over 100 persons to fly out of the U.S. right after 9/11, before they could be questioned?
He had a very personal relationship with the Bush administration and with President Bush himself. The Bush family has been close to the House of Saud going back to the grandfather, Prescott Bush. So when the ambassador called the White House in the hours immediately after 9/11 saying he wanted to meet with the president, he was accommodated. They met in the White House. Prince Bandor said that there were many elite Saudis in the United States. It happened that at that time in Kentucky, the horse sales were going on, and that had brought together not only Saudis who lived in the United States, but Saudis from around the world, and that he, Prince Bandor, was concerned that they were going to be harassed, and asked the president for permission, even though most of American aviation was grounded at the time, if he could get a chartered plane to fly these Saudi elites back to their home in Saudi Arabia. The president agreed with that, and a few days later, after collecting Saudis elsewhere, chartered plane flew from Lexington, Kentucky to Saudi Arabia with approximately 145 elite Saudis, including members of Osama bin Laden's family, back to Riyadh.
Whoa. Let's talk about Osama bin Laden, if we might, Senator. Bin Laden was, of course, from one of the elite families in Saudi Arabia, and there's been speculation that he told the government that he was willing to cause civil unrest in that country, that he was unhappy about certain policies that the government was carrying out, particularly with respect to the United States. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, the background of that goes to the first Persian Gulf War, the one that was in 1990-91 when Iraq had invaded Kuwait. Bin Laden had just come off being a major factor in defeating the Russians in Afghanistan and had some 30,000 war-hardened veterans at his call. He went to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and said, I can protect the kingdom from Saddam Hussein. You don't need to call on the Europeans or the Americans. The king at that time rejected bin Laden's offer and, in fact, did invite the United States and the Europeans, who in the early period of 1991 routed the Iraqis from Kuwait. Bin Laden never forgot that slight. At some point later in the 1990s, when he had returned to Afghanistan and was beginning the planning for what became 9/11, he became aware that this was going to be a very complicated process. I mean, compare what happened in 9/11 to what happened in Paris recently. The complexity of hijacking multiple airlines at the same time, having people who were technically capable then of flying the airplanes, being able to identify the targets and hit them in a very compressed period of time, were daunting challenges. Bin Laden figured out that these 19 people, with their linguistic and cultural limitations, he went to the kingdom and said, we want your support. I'm not saying that he specifically told the Saudi royal family what he was, what his ultimate plan was, but that he was going to have representatives of Al-Qaeda in the United States, and they needed to have people who could assist them, provide financing, give them access to some of the services that they would need, such as flight training, and protect their anonymity. And that if the kingdom didn't do all of the above, he would unleash his 30,000 warriors and start a civil war in Saudi Arabia. The kingdom capitulated and made available to the to bin Laden a network primarily based on people who had been representing Saudi Arabia surreptitiously in the United States to oversee young Saudis, college age principally, who the kingdom were concerned might be plotting against the kingdom in the same way that college students had overthrown the Shah of Iran. A complicated story, but bin Laden played the piano of all of these different people, histories, values, concerns, very well, and the kingdom made available to him what he'd requested, and I don't think 9/11 would have happened but for that.
Is that the reason you think that this has all been covered up?
Why it's been covered up by the United States government is another mystery. It's easier to answer the question for the Bush administration. I mentioned earlier the close personal relationship that the Bush family had with the House of Saud. Oil was another consideration. When President Obama ran in 2008, he ran on a platform of opposition to the war in Iraq. There was a lot of expectation that he would reverse these policies of non-disclosure of information about 9/11 when he became president. And in fact, and I can't say this firsthand, but it's been reported that President Obama told some of the families of the victims of 9/11 that he would release these documents. And now, in his eighth year as president, it hasn't happened. I'm an optimist. I still hold out hope that before January 20th, 2017, that President Obama will deliver on that promise that he has allegedly made and make all this information available to let the American people know what's the nature of our relationship with Saudi Arabia and be part of the decision-making process as to what should we do about it.
Senator, what are you doing now to secure the release of the suppressed 28 pages?
Well, there are a number of things which I hope are going to contribute to President Obama deciding to release these. One of those is this considerable amount of media interest, which had been dormant up until about a year ago. Now there are regular stories and reports, much in line with what we're talking about today. Also in the Congress, there is a resolution to ask the president to release specifically the 28 pages on who financed 9/11. I think there's growing pressure for a release, and I hope it'll reach critical mass in the next 12 months.
The government of Saudi Arabia has been sued on behalf of wrongful death suits on behalf of the family of people who were murdered in the towers. They put up a defense of sovereign immunity. Can you talk about that?
Yes. First, it's very interesting that they have used the defense of sovereign immunity not just to protect the kingdom, but to protect a whole series of charities, foundations, religious institutions, all of which have been alleged to have been involved in some phase of supporting the 9/11 hijackers, primarily financing. Then the Saudi government says, although we use sovereign immunity to protect all these groups from litigation in a U.S. court, we, the kingdom, we're not involved in any of these things, and therefore you can't sue us, right? You can't have it both ways. You can't say sovereign immunity applies to non-governmental groups and then say, but the government itself, which is using that defense, is immune. The status is that under the current law that governs suits against terrorist groups by U.S. citizens in U.S. courts, it's almost necessary to make your case beyond reasonable doubt before you can even get a hearing. And what has happened is that on several occasions, the families of 9/11 victims have been dismissed from court. And I'm sad to report the U.S. government has supported those dismissals. Now the Second District in New York City has reversed at least one of those dismissals, and the case has been refiled, and it's working its way back through the system. And in Congress, there's an effort underway to change the law so that it's not so onerous, and plaintiffs representing persons who have been killed or otherwise adversely affected by terrorists can get their day in court. I hope that this Congress will pass that. It almost passed at the last Congress, and I am optimistic again that that the Congress that's seated today will make adjustments to the law so that it will be more rational for American citizens to find justice.
Senator Bob Graham, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you if you have any final thoughts on this before we have to say goodbye.
Yes, maybe the most persuasive argument to Americans to keep all these materials disclosed is national security, that in some way it would have an adverse effect on our safety if this information were made public. I think it is absolutely the opposite, that the fact is that we have sent a message to Saudi Arabia that they can do anything with impunity, with absolute assurance that they will not be sanctioned, and that fact of the message of impunity through the unwillingness to disclose information in the possession of the United States government about Saudi Arabia's action at 9/11 has encouraged Saudi Arabia to continue to support terrorist groups, now ISIS, and to continue madrasas and mosques, which shape the young minds of Muslims so that they are prepared and religiously motivated to want to fill the ranks of ISIS or other terrorist organizations. So to me, our national security is being dramatically adversely affected by the way in which we have related to Saudi Arabia for its support for the 9/11 hijackers. I think it's an outrage, and I hope that the Obama administration will not leave this as their legacy.
Senator Bob Graham, it's really been an honor for us to have a person with your intelligence and courage on Law and Disorder, and we thank you so much for being our guest.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your carrying this message to the people of America.
Thank you, Senator.
Best of luck.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Today, we speak with James W. Douglas, the author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. The essence of this extraordinarily well-researched and documented book, I would say the best book on this topic, is that Kennedy had changed his mind about being a cold warrior, was trying to turn things around, and that it was elements in the CIA and the military establishment that had him assassinated. We're delighted to have with us longtime peace activist, author, Catholic theologian, James W. Douglas. Jim, in contrast to, say, Cheney, who said with respect to the Vietnam War when he dodged it that he had better things to do, or Bush, who played hooky from the Air National Guard when his dad got him into that, John F. Kennedy was in World War II. He knew what war was about. He was a real war hero, actually. And your book starts out talking about his experiences in World War II. Talk to us about that.
I think that those experiences are, as you've already indicated, Michael, a foundation for his presidency. He was in the South Pacific. Of course, he volunteered, and he wanted to go into the war. He wanted to accept responsibility for the fighting. And he was, as everybody knows, sort of on his PT boat. But what happened on that PT boat when it got split into two one midnight by a Japanese destroyer is the real story. And he lost brothers, he lost people he loved at that time. And he also had this extraordinary experience when he was saving other people's lives of being adrift overnight, really, in the midst of the ocean, trying to alert other PT boats to the problems of his brothers. And during that experience, he both drew a deep distrust of military authority because he saw what they did not do and what they did do in negative ways in the war. And secondly, he basically, I think, was given a mission during that time of trying to end war, and he had the opportunity when he became president of the United States.
That's really the heart of this book. Why did Kennedy die?
Yes.
And if you understand that, you understand the forces behind his assassination.
Yes.
And that's what we'd like to talk to you about. Let's talk about how it all unfolded. He got into office, and right away he was faced with the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Yes.
And what was his conclusion with respect to the CIA when he got involved in that situation?
Well, he said very specifically, I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. He felt that he had been lied to, manipulated, and set up, I should underline, by the CIA. They knew that what they were telling him was false, that there was going to be an internal revolution when the exiles landed. They knew that wasn't going to happen. They even had the terrain messed up in his mind. They thought they could convince him that the exiles could go into the kind of terrain where they could hold out on the edge of Cuba. All of this was false. And the point was to put him in a position where he would have to call in U.S. troops in order not to take a loss as a young president, and they thought inconceivable that he would. Well, they were wrong, as Kennedy said to his friends. They had me figured all wrong, and he took the loss rather than do what he said he would never do, which was send in U.S. troops. He would no more send in U.S. troops in Cuba than he would in Vietnam. He always drew the line at that. I will not send in U.S. combat troops. He wouldn't do it in Cuba. He wouldn't do it in Vietnam.
Jim, can you talk a bit about what you call Kennedy's vision and also explain what you mean in the title by the unspeakable?
Well, to begin with the unspeakable, because that's sort of the backdrop of the book, that comes from Thomas Merton, a monk, spiritual writer, and a friend also, who wrote a book called Raids on the Unspeakable. And he meant by the unspeakable the kind of evil whose depth and deceit seems to go beyond the capacity of words to describe. And it was in the midst of the Vietnam War, the nuclear arms race, and the assassinations of the Kennedys and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King that he used that term. Kennedy's vision is articulated especially in the American University Address, June 10, 1963, which arose out of his turnaround from the missile crisis and from these experiences that we've already been going into, the Vietnam War and back at the Bay of Pigs. In the American University Address, he says that he wants to end the Cold War. That could be the, you know, the basic summary of the whole thing. But he wants to do more than that. He wants to begin not only envisioning, but moving step by step into a disarmed world. And he wants to do that concretely with a guy named Nikita Khrushchev, his enemy. And Khrushchev read that speech, heard that speech. In fact, he put it all over the Soviet Union and all their radio and TV networks, and he said, this is the greatest speech a U.S. president has given to Roosevelt.
It absolutely was, you know, and you reprint the entire speech in JFK and the Unspeakable,
yes.
Why he died and why it matters. We're speaking with James W. Douglas about this really extraordinarily important book. Jim, talk to us about Kennedy's second experience in Cuba with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then let's talk about the back channel he opened up with Nikita Khrushchev afterwards.
Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis is a deeply misunderstood part of our history because it's usually presented as Kennedy going to war with Khrushchev and winning, beating him, sort of 12 noon at the OK Corral and all that kind of stuff. That's really the opposite of the story. What really happened is that both Kennedy and Khrushchev realized they were in over their heads, and Kennedy especially, because his military people were pushing for a nuclear war. They wanted a nuclear war because the U.S. had far more missiles and warheads than the Soviet Union. The generals felt they could win. This is insanity, and that's what it was. And they pushed by sending missiles, even test-firing missiles in the midst of the missile crisis, to try to get the Soviets to move in such a way that they could justify a preemptive attack on the Soviet Union. Well, Kennedy realized all this kind of incredible stuff was happening, and he appealed secretly to Khrushchev to help him get out of that mess that they had both gotten into. And when Khrushchev got this secret appeal that went through Robert Kennedy and the ambassador to the Soviet Union, Anatoly Dobrynin, and of course RFK was the Attorney General at the time, Khrushchev got this appeal and he said to his foreign minister, we have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him. And he almost couldn't believe what he was saying because, of course, that was his arch enemy. But he said, yes, we now have a common enemy to save the world from those pushing us toward war. And at that point, the whole thing, the whole Cold War turned upside down because Khrushchev and Kennedy became closer to each other than either was to his own military and industrial power system. That was a truly amazing point in all of our history.
Very few knew of this secret relationship.
That's true. And it had been going on. It didn't just happen in the middle of the missile crisis. The irony was that these two were struggling in a relentless way over the Cold War and very publicly. And at the same time, secretly, they had this correspondence going on where they were trying to get out of it. And they had the sense, both of them, to realize that they were engaged in a titanic battle that was could destroy the whole world. And they kept under the radar of their own systems by this secret correspondence. And we have that all available to us today, but historians ignore it because it doesn't fit with the public image.
That's why your book is a hidden history that's immaculately documented. It's an extremely important book. I urge all of our readers to get it. JFK and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas. Let's talk a second about what happened, the missile crisis, and then with Vietnam, because
sure.
I had thought about the missile crisis just the way you laid it out, and
yes.
then I also thought about Vietnam, that
yes.
that Kennedy had no intention of backing out of Vietnam, that he was steadily getting the United States involved. My whole preconception of Kennedy as a cold warrior was turned around by the documentation in your book, JFK and the Unspeakable. So talk for a moment, would you, about his notion about what the United States should do with respect to Vietnam and the national liberation movement that was going on there.
Well, I should say, too, Michael, I got turned around. I was very skeptical of Kennedy when he was alive, and I didn't understand any of this stuff when it was going on, and I didn't catch up to it for 30 years. So I've got that in common with everybody else. But anyhow, on Vietnam, Kennedy was drawn into it, and he didn't want to get involved in Vietnam. He made a very strong stand against involvement in Laos, and that typified his early resistance to his advisors after the Bay of Pigs. He negotiated a peace in Laos that involved negotiating with the communists in a coalition government. And so all his national security advisors were appalled by that. So they pushed for his involvement in Vietnam. And he conceded, he gave advisors to the state that had been set up with Diem, South Vietnam. It's a state that was basically U.S. created because we refused to allow the elections. Eisenhower refused to allow the elections that would have kept Vietnam as a single power and under Ho Chi Minh, who would have won the election easily. But anyhow, Kennedy, that's all prior to Kennedy, and Kennedy was going along with this to some degree because he couldn't beat his national security advisors everywhere, so he conceded advisors, but he wanted an exit policy, and his military people would not give him an exit policy. For a couple of years, he was insisting, saying, give me an exit policy. I want out of here, and I want you to tell me, you know, I want you to set it up so we can get out of here. So finally, in 63, McNamara simply ordered it, McNamara being Kennedy's defense secretary, who was helping him to try to resist to some degree the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then Kennedy pushed through a national security memorandum, NSAM 263, which ended the Vietnam War by an order in terms of everybody out by 65 and 1,000 U.S. troops out by the end of 63. And none of that happened because that October NSAM 263 was voided very quietly as soon as Kennedy was killed in November. So he actually signed the withdrawal order from Vietnam before he was assassinated. And Lyndon Johnson turned it around 2 days after his assassination when he met with Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the man in charge down there and out there in Vietnam. And Kennedy was about to fire him, and Lodge said, I'm not going to be the one who surrenders in Southeast Asia.
Jim, talking about the assassination, you
yes.
say that Kennedy knew
yes.
that he was going to die and yet still had the fortitude, the moral fortitude to stand up to the system. Talk a little bit about that.
He had this, what friends who were critical of it would call his obsession with death. It wasn't an obsession with death. It was a very realistic assessment that he was going to die, because if you walk a certain road, if you try to turn around a national security state that is dominating the world, most powerful force in the history of the world, and you try to do so as president of the United States, well, of course you're going to die. Either that, you're going to be thrown out of office by some kind of subversion process, some kind of a coup, and so Kennedy knew that. Now, Kennedy also had a certain awareness of death because of his experience in World War II, so I don't want to minimize that. But he had a very realistic assessment, and he knew when he was going to Dallas that this was probably it, and he was saying goodbye to people before he left, including especially his father and his dead son, whom he visited at his grave site. He did these things just a month before his assassination, And he also, there's an incredible scene that I described in the book where Caroline, his daughter, recites a poem to him in the midst of the National Security Council, I Have a Rendezvous with Death. It's the most incredible moment. And at that moment, Kennedy was both communing with his daughter over his anticipation of his death, and saying, okay, if I have to, I have to, but I'm going to do this thing.
James W. Douglas is the author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, a very, very important book. Jim, let's talk about history and turning points in history.
Yes.
And put this book in perspective. Had Kennedy not been killed, there would have been no massive loss of Vietnamese and American lives in Vietnam.
That's true.
Had he not been killed, there wouldn't have been a massive loss of lives of people in Indonesia.
That's true.
Because he was reaching out to Sukarno.
That's right.
Had he not been killed, there would have been nuclear disarmament.
That's true.
And it seems that, you know, history is not just this inexorable force, that at certain moments people can make their own history, you know, within certain limits, but can make their own history. And Kennedy was trying to do that. And that's what's so extraordinarily moving and sad and really shakes you up about coming to these realizations when you read your book.
Can I add one more, Michael?
Yeah.
Fidel Castro.
A very critical
player in this whole history.
I'm sorry that I forgot to ask you about that.
We wanted to ask about his relationship, too.
Yeah, Fidel Castro and JFK were getting together. That's the underline it, circle it. JFK and Fidel Castro were getting together. There is no question of that. It isn't even a maybe they were. They were definitely, and there were secret negotiations going on between them through intermediaries at the very moment that Kennedy was being killed. He had a guy named Jean Daniel, a very good French reporter, who was talking with Castro at the very moment that Kennedy was assassinated. And they had been together for 6 hours going over JFK's questions for Castro in a hotel a couple of days before, and they were having lunch together, Jean Daniel and Fidel, at the moment that JFK was killed. And when Fidel got the phone message and then the confirmation that JFK had died, he just said, "Everything has changed. Everything is going to change." And that is the truth. And to that, from that day to this, we still have not normalized relations with Cuba, which would have happened in, well, probably 64 to 65 if JFK had lived.
You also spoke about the murders of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Bobby Kennedy. And I understand you're going to be writing books on these.
That's true. It's all one story. The death of those four by the same forces in a period of 4.5 years from late 63 through mid 68, that's a story of the 60s. It's a story of the destruction, the deliberate destruction of hope, not much more so than any individual characters like the Kennedys or Malcolm X or MLK. It's the destruction of hope. It's the destruction of a vision of change. It's the destruction of a turning in this country and in the world, all of which was happening and had to be stopped by the forces that were behind. Well, that's what Merton sums up as the unspeakable, the forces that were behind the Vietnam War, the nuclear arms race, and those assassinations.
I truly believe that.
It has been documented in various ways by various people, but it has to be put together. It's our story. It's our story.
Jim, I have to ask, how did you become interested in this topic and start doing your research on it?
Very specifically from Martin Luther King, not John Kennedy, but for Martin Luther King. When he was assassinated on April 4, 68, I was a professor in the religion department at the University of Hawaii, Honolulu Manoa campus, and in our class, which was on the theology of peace, there were young men who, inspired by King giving his life, and they, as they understood it, and rightly so, to stop the Vietnam War, they didn't think it was... Yeah. James Earl Ray as any lone assassin that killed Martin Luther King. They understood it was deeper than that, and they thought it meant killing him, especially because he was trying to end the war and because he was trying to end poverty through the Poor People's Campaign. And so what they did, without my knowledge, was they had a little gathering, and they burned their draft cards, which meant some of them went to jail for 6 months, some for 2 years. I joined their group. We called it the Hawaii Resistance, and that was basically the end of my academic career.
That'll do it.
That did it, yeah. Well, I lasted a little while longer, but that was basically the end. And that meant I wanted to understand. That was my baptism into nonviolence, not as an academic topic for seminars, but as a way of life. And So now I'm a Catholic worker. We have a Catholic worker house, and we go to Iraq when we can. We do what we can, as you do, for real law, not disorder.
So, well, we're laboring in the same vineyards,
Douglas. So that changed my life. So ever since then, I've been trying to catch up to King's assassination. And in 99, I went to the only trial ever held for the assassination of Martin Luther King in Memphis. 6 weeks, 70 witnesses, and a verdict in a wrongful death lawsuit initiated by the King family, a verdict of, yes, a conspiracy. This is a jury of 6 black and 6 white jurors. Yes, it was conspiracy of U.S. government agencies. That's in their verdict. That's in their verdict.
Yeah.
U.S. government agencies killed Dr. Martin Luther King. In the verdict of a wrongful death lawsuit initiated by the King family, and the verdict came down December 8th, 1999. How many people in the United States know about that today?
It's a hidden history, like the assassination investigation by the Congress said that there was another assassin, not just Oswald. So there was a conspiracy there, too. It's a hidden history.
It was King that sent me to Kennedy. It wasn't Kennedy. You know, through King, I could understand because we had the same politics and spirituality. John F. Kennedy, come on, you know. I had no sense that he was subject to the same thing, but he was.
I just urge people to go out and get James W. Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. This is an Orbis book published in connection with the Marinol Brothers here in New York, very important publishing house, and they've done us a great, great service by publishing this book. James W. Douglas, JFK and the Unspeakable. Jim, do you have any final thoughts you want to share with us?
Yeah, we're in the same scene right now, exactly the same scene. And what we saw going on with Generals Petraeus and McChrystal setting up Obama, it's exactly the same as the Joint Chiefs of Staff setting up and the CIA setting up Kennedy at the Bay of Pigs. McChrystal, Petraeus, they were dictating terms to the president. And unlike Kennedy, he did not face them down. If he does face them down, as I hope he will in the future, he's going to be in the same position Kennedy was. And that's what he needs to be in. That's what we need to be in. We need to be way out ahead of Obama so that he can follow. You know, if the people lead, the leader will follow. So we need to be out ahead of Obama, not waiting for him to do something. And if we get out ahead of him far enough, he will do something. He's a good person. And at that point, he's going to have to face down those generals, which is what Kennedy did, and we all have to face the music at that point.
Jim, I think that's excellent advice. And on that note, we want to thank you so much for this important contribution to our history, and hope that we have you back on again. JFK and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you, Michael.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Michael, hard to believe it's nearly April, and something's coming down the pike.
Yeah, the Brooklyn Folk Festival for the 8th year in a row, April 8th through 10th at St. Anne's Church. You get all the information on brooklynfolkfest.com. There's going to be freedom songs of the Civil Rights Movement, old-time jam sessions, puppet show, square dance, swing dance, and the world-famous banjo toss. So check out the Brooklyn Folk Festival, April 8th to 10th at St. Anne's Church, and that's brooklynfolkfestival.com. See you there. Thank you.
Thank you.